Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio.
Dr. Niamh Shaw is a very colourful lady. She's a scientist, engineer and presenter who has an ambition to fly to space. A couple of years ago, she had a lucky break, an opportunity to experience a zero gravity flight. And here she describes that experience.
I did that in August 2017 and I was very lucky that I got that opportunity. I was speaking to a colleague who's also an artist, and he had made some incredible work with a group of Mexican artists that he's a part of. And I was like, and I called him, it was one of the things I wanted to do, and I asked him, like, how did it happen? And it's incredibly expensive. So I was like, oh, that's never going to happen. And then out of the blue, he messaged me. One day there had been a cancellation of another kind of group, a charter, where they had, they had organized another zero gravity flight for an outreach kind of project. And so I got my visa to go to Russia, and the next thing I found myself just outside Star City, working with the team who trained the cosmonauts at the Cosmonaut Training Center. And we were on the plane, the special flight that simulates this zero gravity sensation. So you get so what happens is it's a maneuver that's kind of like a really sharp angle triangle, like a triangle at 45 degrees up and then down. And it's on the turn of that triangle that you actually go into free fall. So you do that 10 times, so you have 10 episodes of that.
Gosh.
But the hard part is the free fall bit is the fun bit.
But
it's also scary as well.
Absolutely. I say the hard part is keeping your lunch down.
That's weird. When you're on the way up and on the way down, that's what happens. In order to have that pocket of weightlessness or the sensation of weightlessness, you have to experience twice the force of gravity on your body, and that's extremely hard. Yeah. It's awful. It feels like this dull pressure that's on your body from head to toe, and it's really not pleasant. And
that that's G-force, as they call it.
Yeah, G-force. And if you move a lot in that phase of the flight, that's when a lot of the vomiting kind of starts to kick in. But thankfully, I didn't vomit. I didn't know where my body was, so I held on to the bar. There's a kind of a bar that they tell you to hold on to for the very first one.
Yeah.
And I just ended up holding on to the bar for all of them, bar one, group one, because I couldn't figure out what was happening in my body. It's great fun, but you can't figure it out. And then you would go to move, and you give yourself too much of a push, so you go way too far and way too fast. So it's hard to know
very
how
disorientating.
Much you move your body. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to do it again, because the more you do it, the better you get it.
Yeah, I am sure, yeah.
The best of the morning show.
Today is the 81st anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, when Nazis in Germany torched and vandalized Jewish homes, businesses and synagogues. Holocaust survivor Tommy Reichenthal will be speaking at an event this evening at the National Boxing Stadium in Dublin to mark the occasion. You can find out more about it at www.allnations.ie. I talked to Tommy, who was just 9 years old when he was taken to the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, an experience he didn't talk about for over 5 decades. Here, Tommy Reichenthal tells me that speaking in public about his experiences brought up feelings he wasn't expecting.
That was the problem, that when I was writing and everything, thinking about it, I really couldn't sort of absorb the feeling at the time. But when I was speaking about it, and there were sections in my presentation, for example, putting a yellow star on my coat to show the student I had to wear it, I broke down.
Wow.
Because at the time, I didn't feel the humiliation, but now I feel the humiliation. And there were other instances as well that I described in a book, when one of the guards threw breadcrumbs down from the watchtower, and we jumped on it like puppies, like dogs, to get as much as we could from it. Again, at the time, I was starving. It was a reaction. I saw food. I jumped on it like a dog. But But now I feel the humiliation again. Mm-hmm. So thing like this affects me now, not at the time. Yeah. It's just this overwhelming feeling, you know, how dehumanized I was. I didn't even feel it at the time, but as an adult, I feel it just must have been horrific.
It's almost like as an adult, you understand the full context and you understand.
Yeah.
And as a child, all you were doing was just, I suppose you were simply surviving in an absolutely shocking situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The camp was later liberated and thankfully you survived. I've often wondered, because we spoke 5 or 6 years ago by phone, I remember, Tommy, but
yeah.
I've often wondered afterwards, did you speak much about your experience in the years following the war, or did you keep it very much to yourself?
No, first of all, I didn't speak about it for about 55 years.
Gosh.
Not because I didn't want to speak, I just couldn't speak about it. But once I began, it was a reaction that I realized two things. First of all, that I am one of the last witnesses to this horrific crime that was committed. And secondly, I thought I owe it to the victims that their memory is not forgotten. I lost 35 members of my family, and I owe it to them that they are remembered. And whereas I didn't speak for 55 years, now they can't stop me speaking about it.
Yeah, and good thing that it is too. You know, I was thinking about, you know, when the camp was liberated, and you were still a child very much at that time. Were you aware?
Yeah, I was just going on 10, yeah.
10. So were you even aware when you see, you know soldiers in different uniforms, were you even aware that these were, you know, people come to set you free, to release you?
Yeah, of course. There was no dancing and celebrating, because 90% of the inmates were mortally sick, you know.
But
we knew that this dream, terrible dream that we were going through, was at the end, that we were free, you know, even though they said, "You are being liberated," you know, they were shouting to louder, "This is the British Army, you are being liberated." We didn't know what liberated meant, but
sure,
we knew we were free, and this suffering and starvation is coming to an end.
Now, this Saturday, the 9th of November, marks the 81st anniversary of Kristallnacht.
That's right.
the night of the broken glass, which was November 9th.
Well, it will be 81 years this year since then. And many academics do say that perhaps the Kristallnacht, or the night of the broken glass, was the beginning of the Holocaust at the time. Around 260 synagogues were burned down, and 30,000 Jews were arrested, and there were many deaths as well. So, yes, it will be celebrated, and probably there will be programs on television, radio, etc. I'm speaking in the National Boxing Stadium, which the team is A Time to Speak. And I'm not going to speak so much about the Kristallnacht, but I will be speaking about my experiences, and it is due to John Ahn, a pastor that is organizing it. We're expecting a lot of people. So I will mention the Kristallnacht, of course, but it will be basically then my experiences, and also the time we're living now, because it's also a dangerous time.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Ron Huntley was recently in Ireland speaking at the Alpha Ireland conference in Abbeyleix. Spirit Radio's Steve Johnson caught up with the Divine Renovation co-founder and asked him some questions about his life and faith. Here, Ron Huntley shares his favourite line from the Bible.
So my favourite Bible verse is from John chapter 10:10. And I didn't know where that was when it struck me, but I was home one day, just really out of the blue, that scripture came to my head, that Jesus saying that I came that you might have life and have it to the full. I've always liked having a good time. My health was good. I finished university, had a good education, good friends, good job. But I knew there was something missing. And for some reason, God placed that scripture on my heart. And I realized that although I had a lot of great things in life, there was more to life than what I was experiencing. And even though I'd gone to church my whole life, I recognized that I've never really gone all in. And so I said to Jesus, I made him a deal. I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go all in the Roman Catholic Church for 1 year. And if you don't give me life and life to the full, I'm going to quit because I'm tired of being a hypocrite. And that verse changed my life because I'm still here.
Your next question, Ron, is a time you heard something clear from God.
Remember years ago, I was traveling out in the Rocky Mountains in Canada with a friend of mine, and we decided to climb up Rundle Mountain. We'd never done it before. We left too late in the day to make it to the summit, but we didn't know that. We brought no food and no water. We were in really good shape, and we were full of testosterone. And as we're going up the mountain, people are coming back down, and they asked us, where are you going? And we said, we're going to the summit. They said, you can't do that. There's not enough time. We said, oh, yes, we can. Just really naive young men. And we just ran up that mountain, and it took hours and hours and hours. And while we were almost to the top, little did I know I got altitude sickness, and I lost all my energy instantaneously. And I started to get really bad headaches and dizzy, and it took me a long time to climb that last 50 yards. And when I got to the top, I was dry heaving, and I didn't have a liquid in my body. And we're at the top of the mountain with nothing. I actually felt like I was going to die. I wanted to die. That's how sick I was. But I knew how afraid my friend was because he'd never seen me in that situation, because back then I was quite strong and exercised a lot and was very fit. And he'd never seen me like that. And I knew we had to go because we didn't have any time. I was probably up there for a good 45 minutes getting sick and just laying flat out. And if my friend wasn't with me, I would have just stayed there. But for his sake, I kept trying to get up and I kept falling. And I could see the fear in his face. And I had fallen twice already. Only go like 5 or 10 feet, I'd fall again and start dry heaving again. And on the second time I fell, I knew I couldn't do it. And I said, Jesus, if you're real, you have got to get me down this hill. I'm going to get up one more time. And if I fall, that's where I'm going to stay. And it was like I heard the most powerful, strong male voice look right at me, and he said, get up. And I got up and I walked all the way down that mountain and I never looked back. And I never told my friend that. I hope he's listening. But it was Jesus himself that carried me down the hill that day. And it was unmistakable because I had nothing left.
Wow. Yeah. Well, maybe your friend will hear this on the internet. He'll hear that. That is an amazing story, Ron. Well, if we haven't already heard one, your next question is, have you ever seen a miracle?
I was in my early 20s and again, went to church my whole life. Always found Jesus really exciting, the scriptures really exciting, and church really boring, if I was to be honest. And I really didn't understand the disconnect between the excitement of Jesus and the boredom of going to Mass. And part of it's probably my own inability to understand and to sit still very long. I was always an active person. I love to run and wrestle and fight and keep score. And so sitting for that period of time, I always found hard. And so church I always went, but it didn't always make sense to me. I was invited to go on a weekend retreat, and really I just went because of a girl, to be honest with you. And it was really neat, some great speakers. The music was really lively, which I wasn't used to. I was used to organs and really bad choirs. And the whole thing was quite fun. And there was a priest and a lay woman who were kind of the keynote speakers. And I remember after that Saturday afternoon, they said, after supper, tonight we're going to do healing. And I thought, do healing? Like, that's weird. Like, I read about it in scripture, but I've never experienced it or seen it. And so I remember coming back that evening very curious. And so they went about doing this healing ministry, just kind of praying and asking the Holy Spirit to come and expressing words of knowledge of healing for certain people. And I thought, this is really neat. I didn't know if anybody was being healed, but it was just neat to be there. And at one point, the priest said, and if there's anybody else who would like to come forward for healing, just come on down to the stage on the side of the stage and we'll pray for you. And so this was happening, and people were coming up being prayed for headaches and sore backs and things like that. And every time he prayed with them, he invited the people in the audience to just extend their hand in prayer. And all of a sudden, there was a boy on the left-hand side of me, I noticed starting to get up, and he had crutches. And he was only young, I'm guessing between 10 and 12, and he starts on his crutches making his way to the front. And I thought, I wonder what he's doing. I hope he's not going forward for prayer, because he actually has a real problem. Like, if you have a headache, I can't tell. If you have a bad back, I can't tell. But I can tell this boy has a problem because he's on crutches and he can't walk. And I'm thinking, there's no way the leaders of this conference are going to let him go forward, because that would be irresponsible, because we all know he's not going to get healed. And what's going to happen to his faith when he doesn't get healed? And nobody was telling him to sit down. So I started panicking inside. I started praying. Like, I thought, how irresponsible are these Christians? Like, they're going to destroy this young man's faith. And I was panicking. And the closer he got to the front of the line, the harder I prayed. And I'll never forget, the priest looked at the boy and he said, "Son, do you believe that God can heal you?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And I started to cry, because I thought, God, if you're real, you have to heal this boy. You have to heal this boy. And he asked us to extend our hands, and I extended my hands, and it felt like my hands were extending three rows. I was praying so hard, and I was bawling. And after he finished praying for the boy took his crutches, lifted them up over his head, jumped up out of the chair, and ran off the stage, ran all the way back to his seat and sat down, and I just wept, and I just heard Jesus say to me, "Oh, ye of little faith." And I just realized I've put God in a box my whole life, and I had served what I had concocted as a powerless God. He was impotent because of the ways that I experienced my faith, and the little bit that I would put into my faith. God was not the Lord of my life. I was the Lord of my life. And that day I said, I don't want to be the Lord of my life anymore. You are real. You're way bigger than I thought you were. And I just want to serve you and love you.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
This week, Health Minister Simon Harris signed the regulations to commence parts of the Children and Family Relationships Act, which was passed by the Oireachtas in 2015 and which regulates, among other things, the legal status of donor-conceived children. I talked to journalist David Quinn, who is also the director of the Iona Institute, about some of the not-too-publicised implications for children of this legislation.
So, obviously, things like assisted human reproduction, all right, so things like IVF. So a couple or even an individual, might decide that we need to avail of this, but they may not be able to provide the egg or the sperm themselves. So they will have to use what they call donated eggs or sperm,
sure,
often purchased. In the case of sperm, often from Denmark, would you believe?
Mm.
Now, what then is the legal relationship between a child and the parent who used a sperm donor or an egg donor to have the child? Because that parent is not necessarily the biological parent of the child.
Yep.
Okay. Obviously, the other biological parent is the sperm donor or the egg donor. So what are the legal relationships here? And so the Children and Family Relationships Act, one of the things it seeks to do is create legal relationships between the parents who use donated sperm or use a donated egg, or use the womb of a surrogate mother, and it creates the legal relationship between what they call the intending parents and the child. So I hope that's not too complicated.
Yeah, but it does. You really, as you tell it, you can see immediately where the difficulties would lie, because obviously there are intending or intended parents, and then there's actually a natural, I suppose, genetic link,
mm-hmm,
to people who aren't really involved at all.
Exactly. You see, so Simon Harris, anyway, he proudly announces that he's commencing parts of this, as they call it, parts of this act. So the act was passed in 2015, but then you've got to go through this other step where you've actually got to kind of implement the law, and that's called commencing it.
Why are some of its provisions being signed into law right now? I mean, what's specifically going on now?
Well, for example, let's say a female same-sex couple use a sperm donor to have a child. Okay, so what should appear in the birth cert?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
And so what they're now saying is, well, the father's name doesn't have to appear in the birth cert because he's a sperm donor, and the two women can appear in the birth cert as the parents instead.
Okay.
So that's what he commenced the other day. Now, I mean, supposing, just to extrapolate a little bit, he hasn't yet got around to allowing two men to put the names on the birth cert quite yet, although they're planning on getting around to that in due course. But, you see, what happens if, we'd say a single man, he decides I want to have a child, and obviously he has no womb, and he doesn't have a female partner, and so where does the egg come from? So he has to do two things. He might provide his own sperm, but he's going to have to essentially buy an egg from a donor, and he's also going to have to find somebody to provide the womb, to gestate the baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the 9 months. And that may mean going to California, Ukraine, and actually paying somebody.
Yeah.
It's extremely difficult to access non-commercial surrogacy, as they call it, particularly in this country because it's so small.
Yeah.
So what's the legal, you know, what's the legal relationship is there? And so what it would be actually is that a single man, there would be a legal relationship between him and the child, so he'd appear in the birth cert, but the child would have no legal relationship with either the woman who acted as the birth mother or surrogate, and have no legal relationship with the woman who provided the egg, who's the biological mother. So the child would have no legal relationship, or probably any kind of relationship, with either the birth mother or the genetic mother, which is, say, the egg donor, only with the man who provided the egg and is raising the child.
Okay.
And so the implications are vast, because what you're doing is you are deliberately cutting the natural tie to at least one parent.
Absolutely.
Now, some people often say, well, like, how about adoption? Isn't that the same as adoption? But no, it's obviously not the same, because when a couple step in to adopt a child, they haven't cut the natural tie.
Absolutely, yeah.
The mother has said, I can't raise my child, I'm sorry, I'd love to be able to, but I can't. Now, can somebody else do it?
Yeah.
Okay, that's quite different to deliberately always intending, before the child was ever born or even conceived, to break the natural ties. So what it actually is saying is the natural ties don't really matter.
Yeah.
And that is a very radical thing to say, and it's something that's never been properly
It's never been done before. Am I right in saying the government, I mean, because this hasn't been really front and centre. It's interesting, I often come into work here in Spirit Radio, and the first time I hear of anything is when we're really trying to research it, you know?
Yeah.
Has the government been given a fairly easy ride on this?
Well, completely. I mean, I've heard interviews with them. About Simon Harris, that is, asked no tough questions at all.
Yeah.
Just none. It's just amazing that you can have a piece of legislation that gives full blessing to the deliberate, intentional, premeditated severing of the natural tie and the alteration of birth cert so that you can remove the father's, you know, father's name never appears on it, deliberately.
Yeah.
It's not the father's unknown. He's deliberately not on it. And this is done without any hard questions, any scrutiny, any political opposition, any media opposition, nothing.
Yeah.
Because it's an incredibly fundamental question, how much do the biological and natural ties matter? And, you know, we've had all these adoption scandals in the past where adoption was very badly handled.
Absolutely.
And they made it very hard for children to trace their natural parents, and usually the mothers they go looking for, as we know. And we're scandalized by this. And we have programs like Who Do You Think You Are? Where people go tracing their family trees. And are very interested in this. And even if you take Irish names like Mac this and Oh that, they mean, you know, son of or knee that, daughter of.
Yeah.
It's all about where you come from.
Absolutely.
And now we're saying none of that matters.
Yeah.
And we've done this without any debate. The Best
of the Morning Show. Did you know that approximately 75% of sight loss is preventable? I talked to Laura Brady, head of research with Fighting Blindness. First, Laura explained that there are many categories of sight loss that are significant in Ireland.
When we speak of sight loss or blindness, it's important to remember that there's a full spectrum, and we're talking like maybe 20, 30 different conditions. In Ireland, I suppose one of the main forms of sight loss that we will come across is age-related, so age-related macular degeneration.
Which
so
is known as AMD, right?
Known, yeah, exactly, AMD or macular degeneration. So 1 in 10 people over the age of 50 is at risk of getting macular degeneration.
And am I right in saying that's kind of where the centre of your eyesight, kind of the middle range, yeah, goes?
It's area in the back of your eye called the macula, which is a tiny pinhole size, pinhead size, and it's really responsible for fine detail, so for reading, driving your central vision.
And I know RP, retinitis pigmentosa. I worked with a lady who had that on a switchboard many years ago. Is that common enough, or is it rare?
So it's actually, it's probably classified as rare, but actually there are quite a number of people in Ireland living with retinitis pigmentosa, or RP for short. It's probably one of the most complex of genetic conditions, like all genetic conditions. There's up to 70 different genes known to be responsible for RP. And someone living with RP may have very good central vision, but their peripheral vision, their side vision, would be
bad. Okay, so it's the exact opposite, really.
Exactly.
From
yeah.
And what about things like cataracts and glaucoma and things like that? Are they pretty common?
So again, yeah, they're pretty common, and a lot of if you have glaucoma or cataracts, a lot of that can be managed. And even with macular degeneration or diabetic retinopathy, these are all what we would classify as common conditions. They can all be managed.
Really?
And really what we would emphasize is early detection for a lot of these is key, particularly with glaucoma or macular degeneration. So it's really important to ensure that you keep going back to your optician for your eye tests. And particularly like some of the high street opticians, they've become so advanced now with their technology in that they can really pick up any symptoms or signs at the back of your eye that you may not realize, you may not have noticed any symptoms. But by looking into the back of your eye, an optician or optometrist may be able to detect early symptoms. And that's really important then, because early detection means that you can take necessary steps to try and prevent it from progressing into something more severe.
75% of sight loss, as I said earlier on, I'm amazed that 75% of sight loss is preventable. Is that about catching it early, is it?
It is. It's early detection, it's early diagnosis, and it's, I suppose, taking steps to protect your sight loss.
So you catch it before you've lost too much.
Exactly.
And you can stop the advance of it, as it were. Yeah.
Exactly. And be that with macular degeneration, if it's early stage, we call it dry AMD. And what we would encourage people then is to maybe take supplements and to protect your vision, protect what you have now. And even though there's no guarantee, but it does ensure that you're doing what you can to try and ensure it doesn't progress into anything more severe. And I suppose even in terms of, if we look at the era that we're in now and the era of technology.
Yeah, I was about to ask you about that, because, you know, your role as head of research in fighting blindness, you know, I know that you were mentioning earlier on that there have been developments, research developments in sight loss prevention. So what are the ones that you're most encouraged by?
So I suppose if you were to look at, let's say, rare retinal diseases, so these would be genetic forms of sight loss like RP, Stargardt's disease, choroid uremia, Usher syndrome. There's up to 4,000 people in Ireland living with these conditions. And where we're seeing the most advancement for this is in the area of gene therapy. And so what that is, it's actually replacing the bad gene at the back of the eye with a healthy gene.
Wow.
And kind of reinvigorating that whole visual cycle process at the back of the eye. And this is really exciting, because for, I suppose, for these people living with these conditions, there is no treatment available. So they are completely, hope is relying on the research, and that for that research to progress from the lab into a clinic.
Other areas, isn't it? Yeah.
That we're seeing is, you hear a lot about stem cell and cell therapies. And we would always caution around that, in that there's huge potential in the area of stem cell research or cell research. But it's still very much at the early stage, still very much in the laboratory base, and making sure that this is actually safe.
Absolutely.
And effective.
So are you concerned that there might be future categories of eye conditions caused by, say, excessive screen time, or are we still too early in that to be able to make a call on it?
I think we're already observing the impact of the amount of time that we're spending on screens. We are seeing a huge increase in the level of short-sightedness. So the technical term, or the scientific term, or clinical term for short-sightedness is myopia.
Yeah.
And we're seeing an increase of myopia amongst young children. And really, this is down to the amount of time that kids are spending on iPhones or tablets or screens. And so we would really encourage parents to just monitor the amount of time that children are spending. And the same applies for adults, actually. We're all guilty of spending a lot of time on our phones.
Yeah. No, there's no point pointing fingers at the kids.
I know. So, you know, maybe we need to show good example to the children.
Exactly.
By, you know, just restricting the amount of time that we spend on our screen.
The Best of the Morning Show.
The year running up to a US presidential election is always entertaining and intriguing. And at the moment, much of the focus is on the Democratic Party's process to select someone to represent them. Democrats still have no standout candidate, is how Suzanne Lynch of the Irish Times put it this week. I talked to Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at NUI Galway and a political columnist with thejournal.ie, and he thinks the Democrats should be concerned.
Look, it's hard to know what to make of it. I know Suzanne was writing about it. Her take was rather benign. Mine, I wrote over the weekend, and mine was more damning, I think, of the process and what's happened. I find it quite extraordinary that this far into the campaign, that no other candidate other than the big three, that is Warren, Sanders, and Joe Biden, who were the big three because of their huge name recognition, that no one has emerged yet to challenge the big three. The closest to them is Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, and he's polling about half of what Bernie Sanders, the last of the triumvirate, as it were, is polling. So, look, there is still time, there is still a window, but given that things haven't moved at all to date, I think it's going to take an awful lot to unseat one of those three, and in particular to get past Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, who I think are the number two.
Were you surprised to see Beto go out? Because he really was going to be the great white hope about, you know, a year ago, would you say?
Yeah, I think that he, in a sense, he was flavor of the month. I think that when people listened to him, they didn't hear an awful lot. It was fairly vacuous. And
right.
I think some of his personal interviews in which he said, you know, I was born to run for president and all that sort of thing, I think that put off a lot of people who might have been attracted to him. And I think as a matter of substance, I think he was very clearly surpassed by Pete Buttigieg, which is quite extraordinary.
And what do you make of Pete Buttigieg? But tell me how to pronounce that again.
Pete Buttigieg.
Buttigieg, okay.
I've been
doing my best, but Pete Buttigieg. So tell me, what do you make of him? Because he is there, kind of, he's, as you say, it's very much Bernie and Elizabeth, and he's there kind of just trickling underneath. Do you fancy his chances?
Well, look, I mean, I still think this race has a surprise in it, and I tend to think that if there is a surprise, it's going to come from Buttigieg or from Amy Klobuchar, who's from a senator from Minnesota. Buttigieg's chances hinge really on him making a strong showing in the Iowa caucus. Iowa is neighboring to his state of Indiana. He's a Midwesterner. His message has gone down quite well there. That's his chance. If he can supplant one of the top three in Iowa, then in a sense he becomes the story going into New Hampshire. Now, as a candidate, Buttigieg is, in a way, he's kind of a portrait in contrast. He's openly gay. He's married to his husband. So one would, try to paint him into a hard left corner in a sense. However, he is quite pronouncedly moderate and has attacked, for instance, Elizabeth Warren and others for their, you know, rather radical reforms of the American healthcare system.
Okay, yes.
So he's positioned himself in a very interesting place.
Yeah, so in that sense, he's a centrist, I suppose, in that particular way. So, you know, given that you have those three frontrunners, you know, thinking in terms of the next layer, if you like, the tier two candidates, what do you think they have to do to get, I'm thinking about Andrew Yang and Kamala Harris and some of those people, what do they have to do to get their message out?
You know, it always has been retail politicking. I mean, retail politicking, that is knocking on doors in Manchester, New Hampshire, going out to farmhouses and crisscrossing the state of Iowa. That's always historically been what produced people from out of nowhere, one of those being Bill Clinton.
Sure.
Whether it's going to have the same impact this year, I just don't know, because if you look at the polling, it has remained static. If you look at the money that's been there to get the message out, the top three are way ahead with Buttigieg nipping at their heels. So when you mention somebody, for instance, like Kamala Harris, who a lot of Democrats were very excited about, Kamala Harris has pretty much had to shut down her operation in New Hampshire and refocus all of her energy on Iowa because of her inability to raise money and her flagging poll numbers. She's putting all her resources into Iowa. I think an African-American senator from California is going to have a very, very hard time getting any traction in Iowa. So I think Kamala Harris is all but finished in this race.
Why? Okay, that's very interesting. I was thinking about one of the other people there in that list. Hillary Clinton, you know, obviously not running, but she stepped into the discourse last month to attack one of the candidates, Tulsi Gabbard. And I don't know if I'm overstating it, but she seemed to imply that she was being groomed by Russia. What was that all about?
It was an appalling attack. I mean, she did a podcast with David Axelrod, who's one of Barack Obama's former David Plouffe, one of Obama's former advisors. And in that, she said that Tulsi Gabbard was effectively being groomed by the Russians and the Democratic Party, and that she was an agent of the state. It was an absolutely appalling attack by Hillary Clinton. It makes me want to say, get off the stage, Hillary, because
right, yeah.
What has Tulsi Gabbard done? She's made some radical statements. I don't agree with her on everything. But what she has done is say, we need to question how we do foreign policy. And if one looks at the legacy of recent decades of American foreign policy around the world, what rational person wouldn't say we need to question how we do things in Washington? I think it shows in many ways that Hillary Clinton has become captive of the military-industrial establishment in Washington, D.C. I think also illustrates one of the reasons why she was defeated by Donald Trump last time around. And I think the last thing that really makes this offensive is Tulsi Gabbard actually fought in war. She actually served her country overseas.
Yeah.
To say that she's an agent of Russia or that she's being eyed up by the Russians, I think is profoundly offensive.
Yeah, and probably a bit silly to do as well, because, you know, at least on the face of it, she looks like, I suppose, what you might call a patriot or, you know, somebody who is, you know, prepared to go to war for the country. What do you think it was that Tulsi did that so offended Hillary, that triggered her so much to say something so offensive?
Well, I think it's revealing Hillary Clinton's mindset to an extent. I mean, I think that maybe she really has bought into the ideas that the hawkish tendencies that she displayed on the campaign trail in 2016. Maybe she legitimately believes that, and she legitimately believes that America needs to be as interventionist as ever, and that military might can solve the world's problems. I'm afraid that recent decades have shown that that just isn't the case.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.